So I'm fascinated by this subject and have been for years, read lots of different books on it, and I enjoyed reading Dr. George Pratt's book on the code to joy, the subject being happiness, the subject being contentedness, the subject being finding the new baseline of joy that should be in all of us, but you know, for one reason or another, many people are challenged to ever experience, at least consistently. Dr. George Pratt is a licensed clinical psychologist. He's been in practice for many decades. He lives currently and practices in La Jolla, California. But we're going to talk about the book Code to Joy. He was just on back last August with George Norrie, but I did want him back on again because of just this oppression that's coming down on many people as a result of 2020 and even the beginning of 2021. And we've seen, perhaps if you've been following the story, the statistics in so many age groups of people suffering from depression, a sense of helplessness, of powerlessness, and that is exactly what the Code to Joy is all about, the four-step solution to unlocking your natural state of happiness. Next, on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. George Pratt has written more than just Code to Joy, but I will tell you this is how I will know everything I need to know about you, George. You ready?
Okay. Hi, Ann.
When you were at the University of Minnesota, were you a St. Paul guy or were you a Minneapolis guy?
I was a Minneapolis guy.
Okay.
But the trick is I parked outside at the university, undergraduate and graduate, and so the trick was to find your car in the winter.
Yes, I remember.
I don't know if that's more St. Paul or Minneapolis.
Yeah, no, you know, I discovered when I moved there that it was like the divining hat in Harry Potter, that you drove around and you either found that you were more comfortable on the St. Paul side or on the Minneapolis side, and I was a St. Paul guy. It was, you know, you Minneapolis people, you were a little flashy for me, so that's what I learned early.
Yeah, right. The Minnesotans are not known to be flashy.
Well, that's why it's relative, right? I mean, that's why it stands out, those shiny buildings on the Minneapolis side, as opposed to the old city of the East on the St. Paul side. Listen, I so much enjoyed reading your book, and I think there's so many different ways that we can get into this subject. And so I was sort of looking at what my door was. And I have to say, so I'll just preface this by saying, part of my curiosity has always been trying to figure out why I'm so happy, not why I'm unhappy or why I can't get happy. I've always been kind of, because people comment, my wife comments on it all the time, I just have a higher resting place of happiness, and I couldn't tell you why. And maybe it's a little bit of faith in there. Maybe it's birth order. Maybe it's whatever. I don't know. I can't figure it out. I just know that's how I spend my day. And so I wonder, what was your approach when you were trying to figure out happiness, if you looked at it through the lens of your own experience as a human being on this planet?
Well, number one, I think the most important thing is to learn to appreciate everything and to practice gratitude. Now, that's, you know, it's been written about a great deal, but there's a huge body of research of what happens with the brain when you scan for positives rather than just dealing with, you know, the challenges that we have. I mean, right now, probably more so than in, you know, several decades, we've got things that are kind of a mess, but we're going to recover from that. But the trick is to scan for what is meaningful to you and appreciate what that is. And so let's say with the, you know, the challenges with COVID and with political political situations. They're, you know, they're challenging, certainly. But if you think about what is it that is truly going to make you happy, it's being appreciative of what you do have. And that's why you've in other books, too, talking about gratitude lists. But it's a huge thing, because when you start appreciating everything, it changes your brain chemistry, actually, and so that you're more resilient and you're not as affected by these situational fluctuations. Going back to Minnesota, certain times it would get down to, 30 degrees below zero, and you get a freeze, and it could be right. Minus 50 at times.
Yeah, that was just air temperature. It was like negative 25, not including wind chill factor.
Right, I know. It's just totally crazy.
It was another planet. It was weird.
Yeah. And so I did finally, after trying to find my car many times in snowdrifts, I do live in La Jolla.
I saw the shift.
I can find my car every day now.
Yeah, but okay, so I'm not a psychologist. But if I were, I would say part of that answer to me, I would say you're deflecting, or maybe you just forgot about it. Because I want to know, like, where you personally are when you approach a subject like happiness. Do you come at it from the standpoint of you want to figure out what could make you happier, or like
yes.
me? Okay, well, that's what I'm getting at. So where were you when you first started looking into this research in terms of your own personal experience?
Well, I started out, number one, I don't particularly like writing, but I'm more interpersonal. I like people. Most psychologists are not known for having a sense of humor. I have.
Well, I think you've already demonstrated that. You're good. Don't worry.
I'm not, at least I'm not still in a snowdrift there.
Right.
But it has to do with what you focus on. And there were times when people would say with friends that were out of town and living in more, little safer places, a little warmer places, why don't you go transfer to another school so that you can, you don't have that darn weather. And you know what? I actually liked it.
Yeah.
I at times it was challenging, and at times it was hard to find your car. But the reality is I had a near-death experience when I was just turning 7.
Wow.
And so what happened, I had a botched surgery on my throat, and I was I had 16 different hospitalizations for this throat problem that was going on, and my folks were actually told that the docs didn't think I was going to make it. And I'm just turning 7, and so obviously I did. They got me in to see some other specialists, and I did spend a month in the hospital when I was a kid, and that was not, exactly joyful. However, it did give me a tremendous appreciation for everything.
Right.
I mean, I still love snow. I mean, I love the challenges now. But it has helped me to see the world in kind of a new, fresh way that we don't take for granted. We take for granted so much when we have the opportunity to shine more brightly, think about what we're grateful for. And, it's kind of a common thing, having a list of what you're grateful for, but it is hugely helpful.
Right.
We can go into some other techniques, too. But
and we will. You know, you brought up something, though, that I wanted to go back for, and that was I've often used this as, and this is completely, you know, overly reduced. I'm not suggesting it's even all that insightful. But I do think there are times when it's interesting to look at the world in terms of reptiles and then mammals. And that some people, I think, are, and I don't mean reptilian in the way of like their reptilian brain or anything, but I mean, I think that some people are much more affected by their environment and their energy level and everything about their life is affected by what's going on around them. And other people are able to self-regulate their body temperature and or, yeah, in this case, using that as a metaphor, as a mammal. And that's where I often feel like if I had any advantage, and I don't know why, it's that I was born a little bit more mammalian, and I can self-regulate. I can be in the worst possible storm and be happy. I can be in it can be cloudy for a week, and it doesn't affect me. And I understand why it does for other people, and I'm not cold-hearted to that, but I do think that that's an interesting issue for some people. They have to surround themselves with things that make them happy, or they have a harder time getting to that place.
Yes, I think there is a component of biology here. But at the same time, if you think about what you're exposing yourself to in different circumstances, and that you will find the best in even difficult situations, that becomes a trait, and you can become more resilient with that. It's a little bit like, you know, if you think about, you know, various family members, friends, that they really can be kind of knocked for a loop over some kind of lighter circumstances at times, and where you might be able to be more resilient and take it in stride, and essentially we're moving to the subconscious. We have a conscious mind, we have a subconscious mind, and our conscious mind, we have about we fire 20 to 40 neurons per second at the conscious level. At the subconscious level, 20 to 40 million neurons firing per second subconsciously. So if you just look at the conscious situation, there's very little that's happening. But when you use and engage the subconscious, you can do wonderful things. And I think, you know, growing up, both of us in Minnesota, and people have it much harder in lots of places. But it does make you a little more resilient because you're just habituated to it. You're used to standing at the bus stop, and it's below zero, and you know it wasn't really a big deal.
Yeah, you had to get control over your mind a little bit. You had to get control over things, which I think, if I were to relate them to your list of the seven self-limiting concepts that you have in the book, I think that this is where some people have an easier time with that. You refer to them as the seven self-limiting beliefs, and I'm going to read them all seven, and then we can unpack them a little bit as we go along. But number one, I think, is perfect. I really do, and I don't know why I think I would never have guessed this when I was in my 20s, but I think it's so clear to me now that I'm older. Number one is, I am not safe. Number two in the seven self-limiting beliefs, I am worthless. Number three is, I am powerless. Number four is, I'm not lovable. Number five is, I cannot trust anyone. Number six is, I am bad. And number seven is, I am alone. And I thought that was brilliant. I really do. It's in its simplicity. That's exactly. But starting with, I am not safe, You know, I think this is where I underestimate, and I developed now a greater sense of sympathy for people who don't feel safe, or it takes a lot for them to feel safe. And whatever, you know, stupid gene I was given, I feel safe all the time. It takes a lot for me to not feel safe.
That's a wonderful circumstance that you find yourself in, where you feel safe, because that is a very powerful one. And many times in families or in circumstances, kids don't feel safe. And then that kind of stays with them until they do something to heal that. You know, there's some kind of trauma that happens, kind of like what I said with the medical situation.
Right.
But, and so if you think about safety as kind of the major one, and then you think about wanting to feel worthy, but life experiences can be challenging, and so it takes a lot of effort typically to feel worthy and to feel powerful rather than powerless. Kids don't typically feel very powerful, but now as we get older, we should be able to develop these tools, unblock them, and empower ourselves with the feeling lovable, trusting people, feeling you're good, not bad, and feeling that you're connected and not alone. When you feel alone, everything is challenging. You want to feel connected to those that you respect, that you love, and you want to treat yourself with love and respect right there. And so, and there's ways to identify what the blocks are, what the, you know, those were seven that we talked about. There's lots of variations on it, too.
Right.
One of the nice things is we have tools to find out what the blocks are.
But I think one of those blocks, I'll be curious, and we'll get to that. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour. I think one of those things that I've learned is either the block that comes from being the child of an alcoholic or being the grandchild of an alcoholic, where those behaviors are, even if they're dry drunks, the behaviors that get passed down as a result of the impact of the chaos of growing up in an alcoholic environment, and what that means for safety, what that means for somebody feeling worthy, for somebody who learns where their power comes from or feeling loved. I mean, I think almost all seven of those can get tied to the tragedy of generational effects of alcoholism.
Absolutely. And families that have alcoholism as an issue and kids that are raised in that environment, they don't feel safe. They don't feel like they can shine brightly because they're trying to survive.
Right.
And that's so common with alcoholics and parents and grandparents, and there are ways to heal this, which is nice, and unblock and desensitize people, but those are triggers, and those are part of the fog of distress, and it's a little bit like, if you think about, fog. The volume of water in a blanket of fog, 1 acre around and 1 meter deep, would not quite fill an ordinary drinking glass.
All right, that's a perfect way to stop right there. I love that idea. The volume of fog, and in a way, the illusion that creates around us. If I'm pulling on the right end of your metaphor there, we'll come back to it, Dr. George Pratt. The book is Code to Joy. So we're gonna unlock more of your joy tonight, and hope to do that in a way that can make 2021 better than 2020, or at least how maybe 2020 ended for you. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Dr. George Pratt, and we'll get back to it right away. The seven self-limiting beliefs is where we were talking about. And he was talking about fog, and it pertains directly to some of the early responses in Twitter. And I appreciate the comment that I got from somebody who said, of all of those seven self-limiting beliefs, the one that they struggle with the most is learning how to trust other people. But I think what Dr. Pratt is getting at is to unlock our code of joy, we need to address all of those. And we will next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So Dr. George Pratt, the book is Code to Joy. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. We were just in the middle of this interesting metaphor about fog. So take it from the top on that, because I think this is a compelling way to look at what is blocking us.
Obviously, there can be lots of different reasons and triggers for this. However, you know, we were first talking about not feeling safe. We've talked to lots of people about safety, feeling worthy or not worthy, powerful or not powerful, lovable, not lovable, trusting yourself, feeling bad or alone. But the reality is we have a conscious mind and we have a subconscious mind. And that subconscious mind really makes the determinations for us. And that happens from the time that we're just, you know, little kids. So if we're, to use one of your explanations or one of your issues, if you have a alcoholic family and the parents are alcoholic and they might be angry, they might be have a variety of problems, and then the children are exposed to that, and then that shapes their view of life because that's what they expect. So the idea is to identify what's going on and then correct it. The number of neurons that fire at the conscious level per second is 20 to 40 neurons. At the subconscious or the unconscious level, it's 20 to 40 million neurons firing per second. So the reason I said that twice is because it's very, very powerful. When you take that into account, you can then do something to clear this and break that pattern. So that even if you're growing up in an alcoholic environment, you begin to see clearly, you see choices, and you can affiliate with other people. You can do various things to shine more brightly, and you don't have to be stuck. It's tougher when you're a kid, but when you get older, then you can make healthier choices. And the problem is, you know, alcoholism is a huge issue. But if you can do something where you are scanning for positives, affiliating with good people, friends, sports, school, teachers, etc., there's hope.
But you have to kind of retrain your brain on purpose. And I think this is where, I mean, I shared a tweet from a woman who talked about her biggest challenge was trusting people. But I think that idea, as we were talking about the seven self-limiting beliefs, and number one was, I am not safe.
Yes.
And then we get into, I am worthless, I am powerless, I am not lovable. That a lot of these result, seems to me, in control issues. And that people instead of exploring or disposing of these things that are blocking them, they come up with these kind of complicated workarounds, which are a matter of survival. I mean, I understand that, especially with kids.
Yes.
But that's where control issues become self-defeating over time. There's just so much we can control, and then we can't. And the amount of effort that we spend trying to control external circumstances so that we can feel safe, or we can feel worthy, or we can trust other people, that is got to be exhausting to the degree that You're too tired to find joy. It's a full-time job just to avoid feeling pummeled by life.
And that's exactly it. You just get worn out. That's why people need other sources of knowledge, interaction, positive groups, church, other opportunities at school, so that you're not relying on people that may be very dysfunctional. And I know we were talking about alcohol here, and that's a big issue. But it can be lots of different things. It can be depression.
Right.
It can be, you just name it. And that's why we have healthy other options to shine more brightly. And then to do things, you know, we have a conscious mind, we have a subconscious mind, and the conscious mind is a tiny part of this. So, and the subconscious really determines the feeling self. So if you get positive input and influence from school, from church, et cetera, that can really offset some of the darkness of, you know, since we're talking about alcoholism, to shine more brightly. And we're trying to clear the fog of distress. And what you don't want to have is denial. That kind of leaves you powerless.
Right.
And a sense of acceptance. Okay, here's what we have, and here's what we need to do to get things going. Acceptance empowers you. Denial leaves you powerless. And we want you to clear that fog of distress and shine more brightly.
Right. I think that these are wonderful concepts. And again, we're talking about Code to Joy. You can link up to the book through coasttocoastam.com and find out more about Dr. George Pratt and his work there. But this has to have, I think, made 2020 so much harder for some people, because they were... The systems that they had built, either whether they were under the laboratory control systems, you know, like some people do, where they come up with these ways of creating a happy looking life, which they try to fit into, it so much got destroyed by 2020 and working at home and not having interactions with family members and a lot of other and a sense of, and again, it's speaking to a sense of lack of safety, because whereas a lot of people might have been health conscious or hygienic, suddenly became germaphobes, you know, under the COVID conditions.
Oh, yes.
And right.
Yes.
That you must have seen this in your practice, that this exacerbation of all of those of those fears and those self-limiting beliefs.
It amps up everything.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge. It makes, you know, we were talking about, you know, there are some steps to kind of clear and help these patterns and people to shine brightly. But yes, if you think of the whole situation about what's happening with COVID and these other situations, there's a ton of trauma, and then there's people that withdraw, and then particularly kids that are seeing their parents withdrawing, and they're more depressed. It's we want to have people have resources, and not like just having to have antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications. But
right.
It's just like that fog of distress. you know, because antidepressants don't disperse that fog. You know, they blunt its impact, but, you know, whether it's friends, counselors, therapists, that won't do it either. Trying to talk it through is like trying to reach an underwater cave by driving around city streets.
That's a great metaphor. I love that.
Get there.
And so, well, but that's interesting because I would say, as a clinical psychologist, I mean, this is how I've always understood it. Tell me if this is wrong, that SSRIs they're not a panacea. You can't give them to somebody and say, here, you're done, you're cured.
Right.
And talk therapy may not be enough for some people, but if you take a holistic approach where for a limited time they're on SSRIs until the talk therapy has a way of having a bigger effect, then you can get people down off of the chems and they are better able to have an interdialogue or interpersonal dialogue that can help cure up these problems. So you're not, or are you saying that we can just do without SSRIs altogether?
No, not at all. The
okay.
They serve a purpose, and when people are really depressed, to get them going, they can be very helpful along with exercise and several other
right modification
tools.
Of diet.
However, it's very common. I mean, if I have people coming in and they're very depressed and they're on antidepressants, when you go in and take out the traumas in their life, and I'll tell you how that happens, when you clear those traumas, things turn around very quickly. And so they can taper off, and I work with their physician to explore that and to work on tapering off for most people, because the medications alone are simply a tool. They can be a useful tool, and in serious depression, they can be very necessary. But if you go in and get to the basis of what is causing and what happened in the family and traumas from eighth grade or being rejected or problems with the family, when you take out the traumas with various methods, and I'll talk about that, things change.
Yeah.
I had many times people will come in. I have people in about, I've been around for a while.
Yeah.
You know, well frozen from Minnesota. So, the nice thing is there are tools, there are methods for desensitizing and clearing. One of the main tools in Code to Joy is also using techniques where you go back and you use methods to identify what's going on, where was it, what happened, to then clear it. And so, you know, traditional psychology in the past hasn't been to clear things. It's, you know, tell me how you feel. Well, that doesn't work anymore. It can be helpful to identify some things, but you have to have tools to clear them. And so that's one of the nice things about Code to Joy. There's lots of tools in there to clear things and help people be more resilient. So let's say I'll use somebody from earlier in the week. And here's somebody that has gone through a very horrific problem with divorce and a problem with children and et cetera,
right.
et cetera. He was, you know, pretty depressed. And so using these techniques, there was a huge shift in even a session. So the trauma of the frustration with the daughter, wife, the whole circumstance, when you go in and use some of these tools, you can turn things around rather immediately. And so he actually called today and he said, he called on and left a message at the office that, you know, it's unbelievable what could happen so that he could see clearly and think clearly now. And so that, it doesn't have to take forever.
No.
We want to clear them, and that's what, you know, what we're trying to, you know, we kind of start with, you know, with people, we have you identify the strongest self-limiting belief, like what's blocking you, and then you rebalance. Let me talk to you about rebalancing your body's energy system. We are electrical, and we have the tops of our head, Earth has a negative charge, bottoms of our feet have a positive charge, and the top of our heads have a negative charge. So there's ways that you can identify this. Now, when people are traumatized or they're depressed for a period of time, that polarity switches.
Right.
So what happens is you do something about it, and it doesn't take very long. That's why if somebody comes into the office, I say, well, at the very least, you're going to feel at least 20% better today. And that's pretty shocking to say to someone. And then what happens is by just doing a little process that I'm going to explain to you, you can feel 20% better. So let's say, you know, we're like copper top batteries.
Right.
So let's say the person would put their feet flat on the floor and just take a nice deep breath. Let's say did you ever take yoga?
Yeah, I not recently, but up until a couple years ago, we did it pretty regularly.
Well, good. There are seven chakras or energy centers in the body. And if it's easy for those to get out of whack, and they're rather simple to restore, and you don't even have to believe in them. They're
right.
just useful tools.
Right.
So the seven chakras, the ones that are probably most common for being problematic is the fourth one, the mid-upper chest, and then also the top of the head, the seventh one. And so if you do something, let's say with the heart one, you go counterclockwise for about 2 minutes, and then you can actually, instead of doing that over your head, which can be kind of challenging for your arm, you could just also use imagery. Imagery is the language of the subconscious. So if you have water pouring over, if you imagine water pouring over the top of your head, just cleansing, soothing, comforting, relaxing, healing, and you do that and those two spots, you're going to feel tremendously better going counterclockwise. And so what happens is then you rub the spot, and there are some, I have some links to my website that show some of these things, which is nice. So it's drgeorgepratt.com. And people can see these things. So for the top of the head, you just imagine water pouring over the top of the head, let's say for 1 or 2 minutes, and then you rub a spot on the chest, on the Pledge of Allegiance position, clockwise, and then you think to yourself, and it's nice to say it out loud, but you could just think it, I love myself. Now, when people are short-circuited, like what we're talking about, it can, you know, can be fairly, you know, significant. So if you rub that spot, let's say, 100 times, you know, it doesn't take very long, you know, like maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes, just, you know, I love myself, and you can think it or you can just say it out loud. So there you go, you have spun a couple of chakras, you rub this spot, kind of like a reset button in the body, and then what happens? People feel, because they've been short-circuited, they feel restored and they feel 20% better rather immediately.
I like that idea of it being 20% as opposed to, I mean, now that you've explained it,
yeah.
too, I really see that as being, We're not trying to, you know, it would be dismissive to think that you could just flip some sort of switch and the problem is solved. But like anything, again, it's a matter maybe of retraining your brain and your emotional intelligence.
All of those things are emotional intelligence is important. All of those things, yes.
Yeah, but hang on for that. We'll pick it up after the top of the hour because we ran out of time for this. But we have more, and we're going to continue to do some of these exercises together that will help, you know, unlock that missing piece of your life, perhaps. If you're, you know, if you're suffering from a lack of joy. But I want to address maybe to the one person who tweeted about not trusting people. What do we do with that next, too? On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.